This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today we're checking in with a few of the public media reporters working around the state to dive deeper into the stories they've been working on. To get the latest on the COVID-19 pandemic first, we're joined now by Lauren Chapman, digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome back, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into specific numbers around the pandemic, what's the overall sense of how things are going right now in Indiana?
Cautiously, a little bit better. It's one of those things where, like, especially as a Cubs fan, I don't want to, like, throw things in the face of superstition because they can go so terribly wrong. But cautiously, things have improved pretty significantly. So better.
Is there a reason why things are taking on a more positive note?
Yes and no. So historically, with other countries that have had the Delta variant show up and kind of mow through a population, there's this huge spike, and then it just kind of drops off. And this is something that we've heard from epidemiologists and hospital administrators, that this is something that they kind of anticipated. It's the same thing that happened in India in December. It's the same thing that happened in the United Kingdom earlier this year. And so it's following a very, very similar pattern in Indiana. So it just kind of shows up and then one day just kind of evaporates. And that's kind of the way that the Delta virus or the Delta variant seems to move through a population.
Is there any concern that it might spike back up?
Yeah, I mean, there's the one of the big problems is our vaccination rates, right? The Delta virus is not likely to spike back up in Indiana. We haven't seen that in other countries or other places that it has moved through. It kind of does its whole big fireworks display and then it you know, moves away. But the problem is that because it goes through such a large population, it also gives COVID-19 the ability to mutate into something else. So, you know, it might not be the Delta variant that we're dealing with in, you know, 6 months. It could be Theta or, you know, whatever. Like, it will continue to move down the Greek alphabet until we get to higher vaccination rates to really put a stop to COVID-19.
I thought you were going to say until we get to the letter Z. I don't know what it is in the Latin alphabet, but
Omega.
Okay. So when we talk about the numbers of cases right now in Indiana, what are we seeing in terms of number of cases? Are they continuing to sort of ebb and flow? What does it look like?
Yeah, so we're actually seeing a pretty significant decline after averaging more than 4,000 cases at the beginning of or more than 4,000 cases per day at the very beginning of September. We've dropped to about half of that here in the middle of October. So that's a pretty significant decrease from our peak to this valley that we are, you know, heading into. Hospitalizations have also decreased pretty significantly. Again, in not quite half, but pretty close to that. And deaths are also doing something a little bit similar as well. It takes a little bit longer for, it takes longer for death data to come into the Indiana Department of Health. It takes longer to report death data because of the business of dying. But it also, you know, through other previous surges, we see that deaths hit their peak after cases do, just because of it takes time for COVID-19 to get someone sick enough that they do eventually die. So we're seeing that start to come down as well.
When it comes to data that comes in slow, is it just when it relates to deaths, or are we seeing data that doesn't come in fast enough? For example, in a case of a surge, maybe it comes 2 weeks too late. I don't know. I mean, is that something that we're seeing?
Yeah. So one thing that is really important to remember, especially with IDOH, is that the kind of real-time data that we're getting from them has never been done before. And I have to really commend IDOH for how much data they provide us, especially compared to some of our neighbors. So the cases data is basically, you know, next day, right? We're getting that data very, very quickly. And for the most part, that data is really solid. The system that they have to reporting cases with, you know, some significant updates over the course of, you know, the last 18 months, that data stays pretty stagnant. Something that folks at Regenstrief have said over and over again is that in order to really look at the data that, you know, we have from COVID-19, it does require a little bit more retrospect. So it's a little bit hard to look at, you know, a week's worth of data and be like, this is the answer. This is the thing that's causing, you know, X, Y, and Z. So to a certain extent, health departments and IDOH as a whole has a lot of data that they're able to work with, that they're able to understand in a really, really fast turnaround. For death data, by the time that we are getting to someone who is tragically dying from this virus, I mean, we already had all of the information that would have been, you know, able to prevent somebody else by that point. So it makes a little bit of sense. Regenstrief folks have referred to it on multiple occasions as like the data settling. So we're getting that information very, very quickly. For deaths, you usually have a pretty good idea of, you know, how many people have died on a specific day within 2 weeks. And that's not insignificant. That's an incredibly fast turnaround.
When it comes to vaccination for COVID-19, how are our rates when it comes to folks getting vaccinated into the state?
Yeah, it's not stellar by any stretch of the imagination. 56.5% of the eligible population, that's Hoosiers who are 12 and older, are fully vaccinated. When you're, you know, kind of breaking that out into the state's full population, we still haven't hit quite 50% of the state's entire population. And that's not great. That's not enough protection in order to protect against, you know, future variants or, you know, really start to nip this this virus in the bud. We're also seeing that a lot of Hoosiers are taking advantage of booster shots. IDOH updated this data today, and from August 13th, more than 200,000 Hoosiers who were fully vaccinated have received booster shots. That extra dose to add a little bit of extra protection, bolster up vaccines immunity against future variants. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of folks taking advantage of that. The other problem, though, is that initial doses, so either your first dose or the single dose from Johnson & Johnson, those numbers have decreased pretty significantly. We saw a small rise at the beginning of August, mid-August, right when cases were really starting to skyrocket. And as we've, you know, moved through the Delta surge, those have trickled back down to historic lows, actually, for the entire vaccine rollout. So we're really starting to see that as people are taking advantage of additional protection from the vaccine, that the holdouts seem to be less enthralled by the concept of getting vaccinated. So, you know, we still have half of the state that hasn't been fully vaccinated against this virus that aren't picking this up yet.
So would it be fair to say that folks who were already getting vaccinated are the ones that are jumping at the booster and we're not seeing much movement on the other side?
Yeah. I mean, it seems like there's slow uptake. I know that there are a lot of, and to a certain extent, the state appears, mostly because they don't really do interviews, the state appears really focused on working with local officials. They've said this over and over again, that they're really focused on, you know, working on local initiatives in order to get more people vaccinated. So there are a handful of county administrators that a number of folks on the IPB news team have talked to that are, you know, using things like high school sporting events to go out into the community and try and kind of break down some of the vaccine hesitancy that is, you know, central to personal choice as opposed to economic or systemic barriers, while other, you know, aspects of their departments are trying to break down those. So there's a handful of things that are kind of bouncing in the air, but we're starting to see some of those programs getting a little bit more legs, but we would hope that we'd be a little bit farther. That's something that I've heard from a number of epidemiologists over the last few months. We would hope that we'd be a little bit farther along, but you know, the progress that we've made is nothing to sneeze at.
Would you say that we've hit a wall on progress, or it's just going to be a lot slower than folks had imagined?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, to a certain extent, yeah, we've definitely hit a wall. The fact that we, you know, just this week reported a vaccine rollout low, you know, while we're still coming down from another surge of cases, that's disheartening to say the least. And yeah, I think that there is a bit of a wall, even when you're talking about, like, you know, workplace vaccine requirements. A lot of the workplaces that are large enough in order to mandate vaccines already have high vaccine uptake. So, you know, there's a limited efficacy. So when you're even thinking about, like, what can the state do versus what the state is willing to do, which is farther down the road, you know, even unless you go to the point of, you know, mandating vaccines, it seems like a lot of this hesitancy will continue to slow the rollout down.
Well, before we take a quick break, is there any resources or anywhere you suggest folks can check out to keep up to date with stats or numbers or things as it relates to COVID?
This is going to be awful, but Twitter's great. I love Twitter. And
I'm not a fan of Twitter. I'm going to just say it.
I have to shout out WIBC's Eric Berman does an incredible job every single day breaking down that data. And then there's also an economist for IU Northwest. His name's Micah Pollack. He and Gabriel Voslet spend way too much time on Twitter, but they make graphs about data that helps break down a lot of these complicated stats to really better understand exactly where we are right in the moment.
And any other site, like, should people go to the Department of Health and look at those stats, or is that confusing?
I think some of the data has a tendency to get confusing. It takes a while to really, truly, like, digest and understand the data. But, you know, a lot of the dashboards are designed for, like, quick and, you know, simple understanding of where we are to make better decisions about the personal calculus of, you know, going out into the community and taking part.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break and continue our conversation with Lauren, as well as hear from our health equity reporter from Side Effects Public Media. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and we're back with Lauren Chapman, digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting, discussing some of the stories that have been covered by Indiana Public Broadcasting reporters throughout the state. Lauren, our education reporter Jeannie Lindsay recently did a story on child care providers struggling in Indiana. What did she find out?
Yeah, so a couple of things, actually. Indiana's making more than $500 million available to early learning providers across the state. Through these Build, Learn, Grow stabilization grants, which are, you know, trying to deal with something that the childcare industry is really struggling with, which is just the ability to keep their doors open. So these grants are, you know, designed to help with a range of challenges, and I think their flexibility is one of the things that Indiana's looking for, with, you know, basically that money being able to be used to help pay for things like rent for buildings, hiring bonuses, or increased pay for existing staff or to recruit more staff, and even software to streamline business operations. And this goes back to a larger problem where the childcare industry is in a lot of flux. It's hard to staff these centers, and Indiana has a real demand for early learning providers right now.
Well, what effect does having unstable childcare have?
Yeah, so that kind of breaks down twofold, right? So you have the first one, which is the importance of early childhood education. It's a huge indicator of, future success of a person, like for their health, for their, economic productivity. And it's a social determinant of health, like how long a kid lives is determined by whether or not they have, is partially determined by whether or not they had access to early childhood education. And so not having access or having inconsistent access really limits the efficacy of that early learning. But the other side of that is Indiana's workforce. We saw a mass departure of women from the workforce during the pandemic because there's social pressure to, especially on women, to take care of kids. And so, without affordable, accessible childcare, that's a huge deal for a state that's already dealing with a lot of issues, attracting a workforce, having enough of a workforce to sustain the industries that we have in the state, especially when you're talking about service or manufacturing or, all of these things. And so this all plays a huge role in this instability in the childcare industry. Sam Horton yesterday had a story about there was a survey from the Indiana Chamber of Commerce. They did a survey with different businesses across the state. And one of the things that they mentioned was, keeping in mind, having access to childcare as something that they needed to really think about as employers to attract employees. And so, that's just another indication of how important this industry is and how much it needs that stabilization.
Well, I also want to touch up on the recent development in the court battle between Republican lawmakers and Governor Holcomb. Can you give us insight into what happened?
Yeah, Indiana Republican lawmakers scored a huge victory last Thursday in their court battle with Governor Eric Holcomb over emergency powers. The new law, which was passed back in April, March, was HB 1123, which basically it allows the legislature to call itself into session during a public emergency. And a Marion County judge ruled that that law was constitutional. Holcomb had argued that it wasn't, that being able to call the legislature into session was something that was constitutionally something only for the governor. And a Marion County judge determined that was not necessarily the case. It was the exception, not the rule.
Do you expect this to be appealed, or is that it with this case?
Oh, yeah, no, it'll definitely be appealed. Holcomb said the day after that, he's keeping calm. He's evaluating all his options. He can actually appeal the ruling directly to the Indiana Supreme Court. And Holcomb said wanting an answer to the fundamental constitutional question from that ultimate authority will absolutely play into his decision. So it's pretty likely that he will.
Well, I want to thank you, Lauren, for joining us. We'll definitely have to check in with you again for a nice rundown of what's going on. Lauren Chapman, digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're joined now by Farah Yusri, health equity reporter for Side Effects Public Media, to talk about her new story about a community park in Indianapolis. Welcome, Farah.
Thanks.
So let's talk about this story. How did you come up with or find out about this?
Yeah. So as a health equity reporter, I have been looking into some of the reasons behind health disparities and gaps in life expectancy. And in Indianapolis, there is a big gap in how long people live, depending on where they are in the city, meaning that if you look at neighborhoods close to downtown Indianapolis, you'll find that life expectancy is as low as 69 years. That's very low. Like, that's compared to almost like countries like Iraq, for example. And so for every mile you drive south, life expectancy increases by year till you reach the suburbs of Fishers and Carmel. So people living in Indianapolis's urban core live 17 years less than those who live in the city's suburbs, just a short car drive away. And so in talking to people who live in the neighborhoods with the lower life expectancy, who also happen to be predominantly Black and Brown, there was always a sense of, feeling like they are not a priority and that there is no real will to solve the problems that they struggle with. Quality of life and stress are huge issues there. And so parks are a big part of that quality of life. You know, they offer an outlet for recreation, sports, community building. And so that's why I focused one of my stories in a series of stories on life expectancy. I focused on Tarkington Park.
What is the significance of Tarkington Park?
Yeah, so Tarkington Park is at the intersection of four different neighborhoods, and it's in the middle of a very big social, health, and economic gap and disparities. So if you go to Tarkington Park and you look on one side, on the south side of the park, on the north side of the park, you'll find houses cross the $1 million mark. There's a lot of greenery, and residents there are predominantly white. On the other side, there is more concrete, more smaller, older houses, you know, and predominantly black and brown residents. And for decades, Tarkington Park has been a go-to for the black community around the Butler-Tarkington area. Sarita Edwards, who I spoke with, she's a 40-year-old longtime area resident, and she talked to me about what the park meant for her growing up.
It was just like, it was the go-to, like every, like literally we would go there. It doesn't matter where you lived at in that neighborhood. You walk down to Tarkington Park, like it was daily. Like we used to sneak out the house and get in trouble and walk to Tarkington Park, but they always knew where to find us, and we knew we were always safe because it would be a lot of us out there. Like literally playing around, running around, watching the boys play basketball. We used to have dust bowls all the time, which were basketball tournaments put on by the community. We even used to have carnivals there where they had rides, where they actually used to set rides up. I remember we used to have block parties down there. It would be this giant inflatable wrestling ring. So it was so much, like Tarkington Park was the hub of the community. If you didn't have anything to do, just meet us at Tarkington Park. Everybody knew where to go. If it wasn't a party, we would make one, like at Tarkington Park. You would go to 7-Eleven, get some juices, and head across the street.
Yeah, and so you see like this sense of joy that she remembers growing up. But things have changed recently, and that sense of community around the park was challenged in many ways.
And how has that park changed over time?
Yeah, so the park's plan and equipment were more than 30 years old. And in 2012, the city started talking about renovating the park and giving it a facelift, you know, a new splash pad, new playground, climbing wall, community cafe. And the goal was to make the park better and more attractive for people from all the different neighborhoods around the park. And one of the people who worked on the planning process of the park renovations was Michael McKillop. He's now the executive director of Midtown Indy, which is a development nonprofit that works around the area. He told me that he held many meetings with leaders of Black churches, nonprofits, and business owners to plan for the park renovations. And he says he felt good about the process at the time. He felt it was pretty inclusive. It was a full house in many of those meetings. But then when the renovations actually started taking place on the ground in 2015, a fence went around the park to mark the beginning of construction. And then a youth football team called the Indy Steelers showed up to practice one day, and they found themselves fenced out of the park, which they called home for nearly 20 years, without any prior notice. And that sparked an outrage in the community. And it turns out hundreds of other residents had no idea what was going on in the park either. And just seeing kids fenced out of their park was such a throwback, you know, to times when Black Americans were not allowed to enjoy many public spaces, including parks. And that's when McKillop, who was part of the planning process, realized maybe things weren't going as well as he thought. Here he is.
Well, I think when you send out an invitation for someone to come to you, they may not trust you. They may not know you, right? And I think we learned in this process, being part of the process at Tarkington Park, that the process likely left folks out. And I think we heard from those folks shortly after construction began.
Yeah, so, you know, for some of the neighbors there to attend a meeting like that, it may mean arranging for childcare, taking time off multiple jobs they work each day, and maybe even arranging for a ride. And that's a pretty big ask. Also, many of them lack computer access and internet access to be able to weigh in on online surveys and such. So there are systemic barriers that keep the African-American community from having a say, even when it comes to very simple things like their own community park, you know.
Right. It sounds like decisions are being made without the people that are involved, that mm-hmm. that are there day to day. You also mentioned, I read your story, and there was talk about a dog park being considered, and that kind of became a symbol for part of the protest for people in the community. What was the significance of that?
Yeah, so in the very early process of brainstorming ideas for what residents around the park may want to see happen at the new park, the idea of a dog park was mentioned as one possibility. And this idea likely came from someone living on the more affluent side of the area. But the people behind the planning, like McKillop, tell me that this was just an idea on paper and nothing more. It was never part of the actual renovation process. But when the community felt blindsided to begin with by everything that was going on in the park and the fact that they didn't have a say, you know, just the mere idea that there was a talk of a dog park, you know, replacing where their kids used to play, really added fuel to the fire. And one of the slogans during the community demonstrations back in 2015 was "kids over dogs." And that left a bad taste in many people's mouths around there.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty significant thing to change a park into a dog park and again, not consult the community. Well, how did these renovations affect the community?
Yeah, so after the renovations, if you go there now, the park looks prettier, fancier. You know, if you go during the summer, you'll see so many families enjoying the cool water sprinkling from the splash pad on hot days, toddlers going up the climbing walls and, you know, tumbling and falling. And the park also attracts many more white families from the more affluent part of the area than ever before. But frankly, this whole situation left a bad taste in the Black community's mouths, as I said, for a while. Sarita Edwards, again, she's a 40-year-old area resident and a mother, says for a while she didn't look forward to going to the park as much as before.
It was a complete culture shock for a lot of children, right? Because initially, even though that is a multicultural neighborhood, primarily all you seen was Black and brown. I mean, of course, we did have other ethnicities that used to come to the park, but it would just be two and few. So, you know, with this big renovation or whatever, you know, now that it's open, you know, it's just this vast of influx, if that makes sense. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but for children that are not acclimated to seeing it, it's kind of like a culture shock. Like, whoa, because even my children were like, dang. You know, even though they enjoyed the new amenities, it was still kind of a culture shock to them. So I remember my son even asking me, like, is it because the park is new? I said, well, you know, anything that's new attracts new people. You know, like, so, but these people.
Like, it's new, so, like, it's for them?
In a sense.
They don't get new things?
In a sense. It could be that way. Or, you know, more or less, if they think the equipment was too dirty to play on initially.
Yeah, so you mean like kids don't lie, you know? So if they get this sense and they're not aware of like larger issues like politics and racism, then there clearly is something wrong. But don't get me wrong, many Black families I spoke with did not mind the fact that there are more white families coming to the park. In fact, many felt that that was a good thing to have kids more exposed to one another. But also the problem is the new amenities gobbled up the area where the Indy Steelers, the youth football team, used to train on for the past 20 years. The Steelers have nearly 100 kids enrolled between ages 5 and 14. They train 3 days a week for more than 2 hours each day. And so now they have a smaller green area than before. It has hills and dirt, which cause many twisted ankles and other injuries for the kids.
So it sounds like there was a bit of a trade-off, but it's still yet to be seen if it's been that great of a trade-off. Mm. So it's been about, 6 years since this renovation.
Yeah.
Has anything been fixed? Has the community begun to like the park or feel like it's part of their community?
Yeah, so people like McKillop of Midtown Indy realized that maybe the way he went about the process earlier was not the best way to do it. And so there have been so many conversations going on and efforts to include the community every step of the way. The results so far have been good. There are collaborations with community members to make the park the cultural hub it once was. You know, they celebrated Juneteenth there last summer, for example. There are many festivals, basketball tournaments. The cafe at the park is now a Black-owned business. So all of these things were actually born out of the conflict over the park. But then the Indy Steelers still have the smaller area to train on, which is less than ideal. Here's Coach Donald Hamilton of the Steelers.
We were in conversations about putting up some type of multi-playing field or surface, like a turf surface. We've been in talks for that for 5 years. So hopefully it comes around. Hopefully people start listening. We get something done. We just make do with pretty much what we have.
Yeah. And so if you ask anyone around the neighborhood about the Indy Steelers, they would tell you how proud they are of that team and how it's a community pillar. It helped many kids around here. So for them not to be given the resources they need is, you know, such it's very disheartening for people around there.
Does it sound like any changes will be made in that area, or is that something that's still in discussion?
For the Indy Steelers, things are still in discussion. For like the larger picture, like I said, things are getting better. And I feel this conflict over the park can like show us a few things. First, it shows the importance of speaking up and social movements, you know, especially for communities who have been left out for so long, like the African-American community. It also shows that there must be a recognition of the systemic barriers that face communities of color, you know, things that are built into the day-to-day lives that spill over into their health, their income, even their own community park. So cookie-cutter solutions to social problems may not work without first addressing the systemic issues. So in saying that, it seems that people around the neighborhood are starting to work together in better ways. Of course, there are so many more challenges facing people, like the fact that the area is a food desert, gun violence, heavy and sometimes hazardous car traffic. So there are so many things that still need to be addressed around here.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Farah, and giving us insight into your latest story. Farah Yousri is a health equity reporter for Side Effects Public Media. Her reporting on this story is part of a fellowship sponsored by the Association of Healthcare Journalists and supported by the Commonwealth Fund. You can find her work on sideeffectspublicmedia.org. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We're talking to a number of public media reporters today, digging into their latest stories. And with us now are two investigative reporters from WFYI's education desk, Lee Gaines and Dylan Piers McCoy. Welcome to both of you.
Glad to be here.
Hi there. Thanks for having us.
Lee, I'll start with you. The headline to your story last week is Indiana violated federal law by using emergency special education licenses. What is the federal law that we're talking about here?
So we're talking about the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. It's also known as IDEA. And it's the federal law that governs special education services. So the primary function of this law is to ensure that students with disabilities receive a free, appropriate public education. So for years, IDEA has required that special ed teachers be fully licensed. That means that they shouldn't be on what's called an emergency permit or a temporary license. They should be fully licensed, fully qualified to do their job. The one caveat to this is that they can be on a provisional license so long as they're actively working toward full licensure and enrolled in a program and receiving mentorship and support. So this issue about emergency permits and special education got some renewed attention when the Every Student Succeeds Act was signed into law in 2015 because it included a reference to this requirement.
So what are these emergency special education licenses? Have they always been issued by the state, or is this just due to the pandemic?
No, this is something that's been going on for a long time, historically, like all the way back into the 20th century. And emergency permits aren't just for special ed. They're actually issued for other subjects, too. So for things like math and science, for example, basically what they do is they allow anyone with a bachelor's degree to teach a subject that they're not technically qualified to teach. And so schools turn to emergency permits when they can't find a fully qualified teacher for the job. And the use of emergency permits for special education has increased significantly in Indiana over the last several years. And we've been told by schools that that's because of a longstanding special ed teacher shortage.
Well, Dylan, how did you come across this story?
You know, I was reading a application from the state for federal funding where the Department of Education references like the special education teacher shortage we have and how we're relying on these emergency permits for special ed teachers. And I just sort of had a moment where I recognized, like, we are asking people who don't have full qualifications to teach some of the most vulnerable students in this state. And it's a lot. Like, we issued more than 1,200 emergency permits in the 2019-20 school year for special education. So this is a big part of our special education workforce, and these folks don't meet the licensure rules that we set. Like, we've said what it takes to be qualified. They don't meet those expectations. So after I sort of realized that, I was looking into that more, and I was just Googling, and I found a memo from the Department of Education this summer saying, this is actually a violation of federal law, and we're going to stop doing it next year. And that's what set Lee and I down this path of reporting on why they're making this policy change and eliminating emergency permits, and also what that's going to mean for students and schools. And it turns out it could have a really big impact.
And what kind of impact could it have, and what has it had so far on students in special education?
Yeah, so I think that the first thing you have to recognize is how students in special ed are being impacted by the fact that they're being taught by teachers on emergency permits. Like, these students really are the students that we want to have the most qualified and prepared teachers. And in fact, what's happening is that these vulnerable students are being taught by people who aren't fully qualified for the job. There's a big range of teachers who have emergency permits. Sometimes you'll have an emergency permit to teach special education, but you'll actually be a licensed teacher already. Maybe you're licensed in general ed, or you're a licensed gym teacher that's getting hired to teach special ed, and so you need an emergency permit. But we also talked to people who had no teaching experience at all, and they were getting these special ed emergency permits. So basically what's happening is the shortage of special ed teachers is leading us to bring in folks who really aren't prepared for the job to teach special ed. At the same time, when we end the use of emergency permits, the administrators and special ed teachers we talked to basically said this could cause another big problem, which is that they won't be able to fill these positions at all. So they're really worried that without teachers on emergency permits, they're going to have fewer special ed teachers overall, and the fully licensed teachers that are in those jobs will have higher caseloads, and that will make it harder for them to do their jobs well, which could be bad for the students that they do have. It could make their jobs more stressful and actually lead to higher turnover in the end. So this has a big impact on students now, but the policy change we're making will also, students could really suffer in the long term.
Lee, has the federal government done anything with regards to Indiana violating federal law?
No. We haven't seen any penalties. We haven't been told there's been any penalties at all. So a spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Education did confirm to us that under federal law, special ed teachers should be fully licensed, or as I said a little while earlier, they should be enrolled in programs actively working towards their licenses. And so they shouldn't be on emergency permits, that is for sure. And we were also told by the federal government that when states submit their applications for federal funding, they're submitting assurances that they're following federal special ed law. So a spokesperson for the Indiana Department of Education told us that the federal government has provided guidance to help the state comply with the law rather than doling out any punishment. And, you know, honestly, that makes a lot of sense, because one of the primary mechanisms for punishment in this situation would be to withhold federal funding. And I think everyone would agree that that would actually be more harmful to the students that Dylan was just talking about.
Well, Dylan, what is the state's response to all of this?
I mean, they're responding to the fact that we're currently in violation of federal law by ending the use of emergency permits. They also know that could be a challenge for schools. So they say they're going to try and smooth that transition. One thing that they're going to be doing is offering tuition assistance for folks who want to go into special ed teacher training programs. The idea being that they could get those temporary 3-year licenses if they're in a transition to teach program or another program that will lead to a special ed license at the end. So they're hoping that can plug some of this. But I think we're also just sort of waiting to see if there are other things we can do to address the special ed teacher shortage. I sat down with Rep. Bob Boehning, who's the chair of the House Education Committee, to discuss this issue the other day. And he said he was really concerned that schools won't be able to hire enough special ed teachers if they can't use emergency permits. And it's especially concerning because schools only have a year to make this change. And that's a pretty short runway. He said that the legislature might need to do more to address the special ed teacher shortage. I'm going to share a little bit of what he said to me the other day.
We need to start looking more realistic in terms of the responsibility of a special ed teacher versus a traditional classroom teacher. And, you know, it is much more, it's a situation that requires a lot more expertise, more training potentially. So perhaps we ought to be looking at salary structures a little bit too.
That's an interesting take on it. Do you think that those are things that need to be weighed on?
Yeah, I think this is going to be an interesting issue to watch the legislature tackle. We know we have a special ed teacher shortage. We've had it for years, and we haven't really made progress on it. It actually seems to be getting worse. I talked to lawmakers, Republican and Democratic lawmakers, and they agree that this problem is really serious. They agree that the state needs to do something to incentivize people to become special ed teachers. But what the solution is, I think, could actually prove to be more controversial once we sort of dig down into it. What Rep. Boehning is suggesting is that maybe special ed teachers should be paid more than teachers in other areas. You know, he's saying their job is harder and we can't fill those positions, so we should potentially be paying special ed teachers more than we're paying a elementary school teacher. But that's not typical of the way that teacher contracts work. Normally, teacher contracts sort of stipulate that teachers are paid the same amount across fields. So you might be an elementary school teacher or you might be a math teacher, and you're going to be getting paid the same amount typically. And so changing that would actually be a pretty controversial move. So I'm going to be really interested to see if this gets the kind of attention we might expect in the legislature this session. And if so, whether it becomes a fight or whether there are areas of consensus that lawmakers and advocates believe will really move the needle on this.
Lee, you talked to Jenny Smithson, a member of the Indiana Council of Administrators for Special Education and the special ed director for Muncie Community Schools. What did you hear from her?
So to be clear, you know, Smithson agrees that all special ed teachers should be fully licensed, that the state of Indiana should be following federal law here. But the reality is that schools are struggling to hire those individuals. You know, she says they've become increasingly reliant on emergency permits to fill the gap and make sure students have at least, you know, some teacher in the classroom. You know, something that she is concerned about is that if you eliminate these emergency permits, then that means that there will be more students on the caseloads of fully licensed special ed teachers in districts. And, you know, I've heard anecdotally that those caseloads are already really high. And so we actually have a clip of Smithson talking about this.
And how do you help them keep from that burnout that happens when you have a caseload that's way higher than you should? I mean, we don't have caseload limits here in Indiana like some states do. So, I mean, we have the kids, we have to serve them. And if we only have so many licensed teachers, then we have to spread the love.
So there isn't a limit on how many caseloads teachers can take?
Yeah, there is no limit on the number of students and on a special ed teacher's caseload. You know, I've heard numbers ranging from like 20 to more than 30 for teachers. And then we also have this issue that Smithson talked to me about, which is the cost to get certified to teach special ed. So, you know, you're a new teacher, you realize that this is something you're passionate about and you want to do, and there's a huge shortage, so there's a lot of jobs in special ed, and you decide to go back to school and, you know, get that certification. And here's Smithson talking about the issue with that.
I mean, some school districts had a starting salary of like $34,000. How do you pay back your student loans and pay all your bills and work on your degree in special ed at the same time? It's been hard for them to try to do that.
And something I want to note here is that the state of Indiana is planning to roll out a tuition reimbursement program. That's something that they've told us. So if you are actively seeking your special ed credentials, you should be able to get some money back from the state. But they haven't released details on that program. And as Dylan mentioned, we only have a year runway, less than a year at this point.
Yeah, I mean, and just thinking of a salary of $34,000, that's, you know, you're getting a great deal to hire a teacher at that salary, but then not to give them the ability to pay back their loans and expect them to be taking special ed classes. That seems like a lot.
It is. It's a lot for anyone to do. And their work, you know, they're working full time. It's a time commitment as well as a money commitment.
Right, right. And Dylan, have any schools or school districts weighed in on this?
Yeah, absolutely. We reached out to some school districts to talk a little bit more about how they are preparing for this change. The school districts are under a lot of pressure right now, especially school districts that have relied on these emergency permits more than others. They're talking to local higher education institutions about what sort of transition to teacher programs exist and whether they're going to be able to get their teachers who are on emergency permits into those programs to make sure that they can get these temporary licenses that the state is going to be issuing. And they're working with teachers who are on emergency permits to make sure they, you know, finish up their schooling if they're in school right now so that they can get a regular permit. But they're still kind of scrambling. I spoke with an assistant superintendent in South Bend, and he told me that he's concerned that the district might not be able to hire enough special ed teachers next year. And that what that's going to mean is that the sort of students will suffer. The quality of their education will decline because caseloads will increase for the special ed teachers that the district does have.
Lee, are there any reasons that we didn't discuss that could be causing a shortage, a teacher shortage, particularly in special ed?
So we touched on this a little bit, but pay is one, you know, that's something that Representative Boehning mentioned. So, you know, Jenny Smithson said that is an issue for her. She's really thinks that special ed teachers should be paid more. So as Dylan has mentioned, you know, you aren't guaranteed a higher salary than a general ed teacher if you become a special ed teacher. But at the same time, special ed teachers have extra paperwork responsibilities, and they also need to know and understand federal special ed law. You know, we've heard stories about special ed teachers becoming general ed teachers for that reason. You know, it's the same amount of pay for less paperwork. As I mentioned before, we've also heard about high caseloads contributing to burnout, and that can be an issue for retention, especially if maybe you're the only fully licensed special ed teacher in your district. That's a lot for an individual to take on. Another issue that we've heard about is special ed certification isn't a standard feature of a teacher prep program. So if you don't already know that you want to be a special ed teacher, you're not necessarily going to come out of school qualified to teach special ed. So you might be in the position of being that, you know, teacher making $34,000 to $40,000 a year. You realize that getting special ed certified is something you want to do, but then, oh, wait, you have to go back and do more coursework in order to do that. That could be, you know, that could deter you from wanting to get into special ed.
Well, we have about a minute and a half left. Dylan, can you tell us about Susan Harrison, a teacher you talked to for the story?
Yeah, Susan was a really interesting person to talk to. She was hired on an emergency permit a few years ago, and she had a lot of informal experience. She'd adopted young children with special needs, and she'd worked in a home-based daycare, but she had no formal teaching experience. She didn't have a license, and she really felt totally unqualified when she first got hired. I'm going to share a little bit of my interview with her.
I was scared to death just because it was something I'd never done before. And, you know, you have to write lesson plans. You have to, you know, monitor everybody's individual goals. There was no training and you were just put in a room and you were on your own. I had one of the administrators come out one day. She sat with me for an hour and that was my training.
And so it sounds like this is definitely an issue that has to be tackled.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, these are the most vulnerable students in the state that we're talking about. And as Dylan said before, they are the ones that honestly need the most qualified teachers.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us this afternoon and shedding light on this very important topic. Lee Gaines and Dylan Piers McCoy are investigative reporters for WFYI's Education Desk. You can find their work at WFYI.org/news. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.